Weird World.
Welcome to Our Weird World. I'm your host, John Henson. Back at normal volume this week. There's not a baby sleeping in the next room this time. So I don't know how that's going to turn out. You can let me know. You can say, hey, never do that again. Or, hey, maybe you should consider this is really good format. I don't know. But anyway, this week, dude, it's so early. I'm not awake yet. I'm also kind of hungover, if I'm being honest. Yeah, I don't know how this episode's going to go. What are we talking about? Part 3 of Amazing Tales of Survival, 5 stories, today of people named Truman Duncan, Channing Moss, the Miracle Baby. That's not like their government name, but well, you'll understand. Joan Murray, and our first story after the music of Charles Lightoller. Charles Herbert Lightoller was born on March 30th, 1874 in Lancashire, England. His mother died of scarlet fever shortly after he was born. And then when Charles was 10, his dad decided to run off to New Zealand and abandon everyone, leaving Charles and his siblings to be raised by other family members. Seeing as he was basically destined to become another child worker in Britain's factories at the time, Lightoller decided to try to take a different path and began an apprenticeship on the Primrose Hill, which was a large cargo sailboat, at age 13. And like, God, we talk about like how bad kids have it now. Maybe they do. Maybe people don't. I don't know. But like, at least it's not in the 1800s when like you turn 10 and you get sent to this factory to work, you know, could be worse, I guess. Lightoller later joined the Holt Hill, which was another cargo ship, but was forced to land in Rio de Janeiro during a violent revolt and a smallpox epidemic, by the way, after a storm damaged the ship. On November 13th, 1889, at age 15, the ship was run aground by another small storm on a small uninhabited island. The crew was eventually rescued and then sent over to Adelaide, Australia. In 1895, Lightoller began working on steamships after working his way up to first mate. He spent time working for the African Royal Mail Service, but nearly died of malaria after having also survived another tropical storm and a massive coal fire on 2 other ships. For a brief time, Lightoller avoided working on ships altogether, which is probably smart, by prospecting for gold in the Yukon Territory in Canada during the Klondike Gold Rush. However, that kind of operation failed. He didn't really get any success there, so he tried working as a cowboy in Alberta, Canada. That didn't work either, and so Lightoller basically kind of lived as a hobo for a year before making his way back to England. In 1900, Lightoller, possibly reluctantly, returned to working on ships and got a job as fourth officer on the White Star Line's SS Medic. Over the next decade, Lightoller worked his way up the ranks as first mate and first officer. He also married Australian Sylvia Hawley Wilson in Sydney, who he then took back to England on a return voyage on one of his ships. In 1912, Lightoller boarded the RMS Titanic as first officer. Don't jump ahead. All right. Maybe you don't know what happens. On April 14th, Lightoller was in charge of the final watch on the bridge, ordering the lookouts to watch for ice. And as Lightoller retired to his cabin, he felt the ship collide with that famous iceberg. Lightoller rushed out to the deck in his pajamas to kind of figure out what had happened, but didn't really see anything amiss and went back to bed. However, obviously, you know how this part of the story goes. Things started going downhill. Lightoller was summoned back to the deck to help evacuate the ship. He quickly worked to fill several lifeboats on the port side with only women and children, despite having some space available for men. He was not letting dudes go. On one occasion, he found a lifeboat already full with 25 men and crew members and angrily ordered all of them out of the boat, and actually threatened to shoot them with his revolver, even though it was empty, if they disobeyed. That 40-person boat was soon replaced with 17 women and children and then dropped into the ocean, which seems really inefficient because I mean, what's 25 plus 17 here? Math. 42. I mean, put some kids on laps, and that everybody could have just gotten on that same boat, but whatever. Anyway, as the Titanic began to disappear beneath the surface, Lightoller tried to launch lifeboat collapsible B, but it fell off the deck and landed upside down. So they've just lost an entire lifeboat on the Titanic. As the freezing water rolled over the deck, and with nothing else he could do, Lightoller climbed to the roof of the officer's quarters and jumped into the ocean. He quickly turned to see the crow's nest now basically even with the water surface before he was suddenly like sucked under by the pressure of the sinking ship and was actually pinned against the grating of one of the ship's ventilators. When one of the boilers on the Titanic exploded, Lightoller was actually launched back up to the surface and actually found that collapsible B life raft that he had accidentally dropped off the side of the ship, just kind of floating in the ocean with several other survivors already clinging to it. He swam over, tried to calm those people down, and then began teaching them how to shift their weight with the rising ocean swells in hopes of staying alive long enough to be rescued. Eventually, another lifeboat came along and actually did rescue them, and Lightoller actually was the last survivor taken aboard the RMS Carpathia when it arrived. So, maybe you didn't know how that story was going to end. Despite surviving one of the worst maritime disasters in the world, this dude returned to work the following year on the White Star Line, serving as a mate on the RMS Oceanic. When World War I broke out, Lightoller then served in the Royal Navy, where he patrolled the Dover Straits, engaging German destroyers and conducting nighttime raids. On April 1st, 1918, his ship, the HMS Falcon, actually collided with the trawler John Fitzgerald in dense fog as the two were both kind of acting as escorts to a convoy in the North Sea. Lightoller's ship sank, and although he was court-martialed for the sunken ship, he was ultimately exonerated and commended for actually staying on board until everyone was rescued. After World War I, Lightoller struggled to find employment, as anyone who had been formerly associated with the Titanic was deemed unemployable. Basically, anyone who was in charge of anything that happened on the Titanic and survived was pretty much like blacklisted from society in terms of getting another job, because it's like, I wonder if that was just like maritime jobs, or it's just like jobs in general, right? Like, just imagine dude just showing up for work at like a restaurant just to be not even a waiter, just a host, right? And it's just like, oh, I look at your resume, very impressive here, a lot of work here, first mate on several. Oh, you were on the Titanic. You were actually an officer on the Titanic. That is, that's a little problematic. Are you going to be able to like effectively send our guests to their seats? Or are you going to like, I don't know, clip a chair along the way and fall over and spill someone's water and kill people? Anyway, I don't know. It seems a little bit extreme, but you know, again, this was like the worst thing that had ever happened ever at the time. So I get how people might be a little hesitant to hire anyone from there. So because he couldn't really find a job, he worked as an innkeeper and a chicken farmer and wrote a successful autobiography. When World War II began, Lightoller actually returned to the maritime world in his own private yacht, the Sundowner, to help the British with the Dunkirk evacuation. Although his boat was only licensed to carry 21 passengers, Lightoller somehow crammed 127 soldiers on board and took them all to safety, all while dodging gunfire from enemy aircraft overhead. His actions were portrayed as the character Mr. Dawson in the 2017 film Dunkirk, by the way. Following the war, Lightoller took over a boatyard in Twickenham. He died at age 78 of heart disease, thanks to his lifelong smoking and the great smog of 1952. And shockingly, not from a sinking ship. Like, all the things that he survived. I mean, like, several, like, at least on, like, two or three ships that sank. Ships that had massive fires. He survived, you know, a couple of epidemics. Like, he survived malaria. He survives all these things and then just retires and dies of heart disease. So Our next story here, a little bit shorter. On September 25th, 1999, Joan Murray decided to go skydiving. She had done it 35 times before, never had any issues, and figured, yeah, she could do it again. What could go wrong? And nothing did. The jump was successful. Murray went back to work at her Bank of America office in Charlotte. No, of course not. As she jumped from 14,500 feet, her main parachute malfunctioned. And so she's just a rock falling to the ground at this point. She's fighting to try to get her reserve chute opened. And it finally does, just 700 feet from the ground, which isn't great. All right. You do need a little bit more than that. 700 feet is a long way up. Right. I get that. But it is not a long way up enough when you're falling out of the sky. Also, it's even worse when that reserve chute never fully expands. And so this lady hits the ground at 80 miles an hour. Even worse, she landed on a giant mound of fire ants, because this is North Carolina where this happened. Now, here's the thing. This woman survives. Obviously, that's why she's in this episode. And people cannot understand why. Because, first of all, if you hit anything at 80 miles an hour, it's going to hurt, all right? Like, you get hit with a baseball at 80 miles an hour. That's fine. That hurts. But that's like a small thing hitting you. Imagine taking your entire self, right? Or take your car. Actually, don't do this. But take your car and drive 80 miles an hour, like, into a wall, all right? It's going to mess you up, all right? Your car is going to really be messed up. So this is a woman without any kind of protection, smacking the ground at 80 miles an hour and smacking a massive mound of fire ants. Now, according to non-medical sources, and I need to specify non-medical sources here, because people believe that the reason that she survived was because she landed on these fire ants and received over 200 ant stings, which produced enough adrenaline through Murray's body to keep her alive. And whether that's true or not, it's probably not true. Medical experts kind of dispute that. Rescuers were shocked to find that she was alive. Her entire right side had been shattered. Several fillings had been knocked out of her teeth. But other than that, she was alive. They put her in a coma for 2 weeks. She underwent 20 reconstructive surgeries and 17 blood transfusions. But Murray made a full recovery, went back to work, and even went on another skydive the following year. Our next story here. On March 16th, 2006, Channing Moss and roughly two dozen other members of the 10th Mountain Division loaded into five armored Humvees to visit a remote village of tribal elders in Afghanistan for, you know, war stuff. A few miles from the village, the convoy was ambushed by Taliban soldiers, as typically happens over there. The peaceful car ride through the Afghan mountains quickly turned into chaos as, like, rocket-propelled grenades started raining down on them from the mountainside. One of them blew up an Afghan National Army truck and killed two Afghan soldiers. The convoy then stopped, and the American soldiers, moved into a position so that they could return fire. Suddenly, though, Channing Moss's truck was hit with two rockets, one of which, this whole rocket, decided to lodge itself in Moss's abdomen. Jared Angel, who initially noticed the rocket sticking out of Moss's side, quickly moved to bandage all of the wounds and stabilize the rocket so that it wouldn't detonate and kill everyone in a 30-foot radius. So this is wild, right? Because, like, soldiers, I kind of thought, like, soldiers were out there, not necessarily, like, as padded as, like, a football player, but, like, I thought they had, like, some Kevlar underneath them. Maybe not. It's the desert. It's hot. They need to be able to move quickly. I don't know how war works, you guys. But dude has an entire rocket. Now, like, it's like a rocket propelled grenade. So, like, it's not like a rocket that, like, goes to space. It's not, like, that big of a rocket, but it's probably, like, I mean, it's bigger than a football, probably. So I don't know. I'm trying to think of something that's comparable. Imagine having, like a big Italian baguette, you know, just a big old loaf of Italian bread sticking out of your stomach. That's probably what it was comparable to, if I'm being honest. So homeboy, he has this giant baguette of detonation and destruction coming out of his body because he got hit with it. It hit him and somehow didn't detonate, which is crazy. So for the next 15 minutes, soldiers basically stopped everything and worked to clear the area so a medevac crew could come and extract all the people that were injured, including Moss. Billy Mariani, who was in charge of ordering this evacuation, conveniently left out the fact that Moss had a live rocket inside of him out of concern that the military would just decide against sending anybody and not saving anyone. Mainly because the Army does have a strict policy of not touching people with live rockets inside of them. I think that is in the rule book. Fortunately, the medical crew that arrived on the scene was actually totally fine with all of this and disobeyed Army policy to save Moss's life. So they evacuate him and the other injured people out. And once they landed at the field hospital, Major John O, the general surgeon at the base, took a look at Moss's injury and obviously realized the full scope of what was going on. However, again, despite having a policy against touching people with live rockets inside of them, the military had also trained Dr. O and other doctors on how to remove live rockets from people on the off chance that that was a thing that happened. Because the military is just super thorough like that. The military is the autism of the government. Super rigid, super structured, super detail oriented. No stone is going to be left unturned. All right. And so even things that they don't allow you to do, they train you just in case you find yourself in that situation anyway. And I can appreciate that kind of detail. Elsewhere, while this is going on, soldier Dan Brown, not the author, I think there's an author named Dan Brown. Anyway, you get it. He had just finished watching an episode of Grey's Anatomy in which a patient had an unexploded grenade in his body. So this is all working out, you know, life imitates art because Grey's Anatomy, they've also covered every possible scenario. Of course, in the show, the patient blew up and killed the bomb technician in the episode. Maybe you saw that episode and then Snow Patrol started playing. I don't know. But Brown, he knew what had gone wrong in that episode. He knew what McSteamface or whatever did wrong in there. That's probably not who it was, but he knew what they had done wrong. And so he knew what to do right, because obviously you should know that TV is 100% accurate, even Grey's Anatomy. So after taking 3 x-rays to determine whether or not the warhead was attached and inside Moss to be sure, they were relieved to find that the main explosive charge was actually missing from this rocket. However, Brown warned that the exploding rocket could still kill everyone surrounding Moss if it did blow up. So Dr. O and 6 other medical staff members immediately got to work. By now, Channing Moss had lost so much blood that his heart had actually stopped beating. And at that point, everyone just kind of realized it was pointless to keep going. So they moved Moss out to an open part of the desert and detonated the warhead inside of his body. It was just like a big old fireworks of guts and stuff. And so really, this was more about all of the other soldiers that survived and not Channing Moss. So I'm kidding. Again, obviously, they kept going. Right. They kept operating on this dude because that's what the military does. So rather than performing chest compressions out of fear of detonating the warhead, Moss was actually given a giant dose of epinephrine, which restarted his heart and brought him back to life. Brown then grabbed a hacksaw and then removed the tail fins from the rocket while other surgeons gently began pulling this rocket. And this is how big this thing was. The rocket, and I'm not entirely sure how this even happened, but this rocket stretched from his thigh to just below his heart. And I don't even know how that happens. But again, pretty accurate description earlier, just a big old Italian baguette, just a big old loaf of Italian bread that explodes and kills people inside this dude's body. I don't know where I still don't know, from your thigh to your heart. That's vertical. So I don't even know how a rocket would do that. Unless, I mean, maybe like straight out of the sky and just kind of I don't know, man. I don't know. But this is what happened. Why would the military lie about this thing? Where are we at? So within minutes, they extract this entire rocket out of Channing Moss's body. And Dan Brown walks out of the hospital with this bloody rocket and finds a safe place to detonate it. A few days later, Moss was back in the United States at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. His pelvis had been shattered. His internal organs were all kinds of mangled because that's what happens when a rocket goes through them. After four major surgeries and intense physical therapy, Moss actually made a full recovery and made a point to walk to receive his very well-deserved Purple Heart. Our next story here. In May of 2008 in Holly Springs, Mississippi, Michael Elliott walked into his kitchen holding his 10-month-old cousin. The family was kind of mulling around, probably preparing a big meal. I'd like to imagine that someone suddenly just lit up a nice, dank, black and mild, because that's fun for me. And then suddenly, thanks to a gas leak that no one expected after they lit the black and mild, the house exploded, burying everybody under a pile of burning rubble, except for the grandpa, who was jettisoned over to the next door neighbor's yard. Firefighters quickly came on the scene. They got into the house, pulled everyone out, except for the 10-month-old cousin, who I mentioned up at the start, because that's how storytelling works, which no one could seem to find. No one had any idea where this baby was. Deciding that they should probably start to put the fire out, firefighters then dumped hundreds of gallons of water on this house. And then once the fire was fully out, the firefighters and neighbors spent the next 10 hours pulling debris from what used to be an actual house, but then had to stop because a thunderstorm had descended on the neighborhood and began dumping even more water on the rubble. 4 hours later, the search resumed, and though everyone at this point just kind of assumed they were looking for a dead baby, an hour later they realized that only half of the basement in this house had collapsed. And when they had finally pulled back enough debris to get to the remaining part of the basement, they found the 10-month-old, who was subsequently dubbed the Miracle Baby, just sitting on the floor, was totally dry, totally not burned to a crisp, just like totally fine. And like, no one's really sure how that happened, considering, you know, the baby was in the kitchen when the gas leak that was probably coming from the oven in the kitchen exploded, right? So that's real close proximity to fire. House totally explodes. Everyone else, I think, makes it out somehow, but the baby's gone. And like scientists, like the best guess that scientists could give to how this happened was that the explosion caused Miracle Baby to fall through the floor before the roof and second floor of the house could fall on top of her and crush her, which then left a gap that not only protected her from the fire, but then also the following floods of water from the fire department and the thunderstorm. So it was just like a really, like, just a very lucky situation, hence, you know, Miracle Baby. Because this was Mississippi, the neighborhood then got together and cooked up 600 pounds of catfish and 5,000 hush puppies to raise money for Miracle Baby's medical expenses, which only included an arm injury and blood test to basically just see what sort of supernatural midichlorians were floating around inside this baby. Because it didn't make sense how this baby was basically unharmed, like had a small arm injury from probably where she fell through the floor and landed, but otherwise was totally fine. Our final story here, a little short one. In June 2006, Duncan Truman was working the rail yards in Cleburne, Texas, a small town just a few miles south of Fort Worth, when he inexplicably fell onto the tracks. And normally, like, that wouldn't be an issue because if you fall on railroad tracks, you can just stand up and move, like, literally a little bit and you're fine. But he fell directly in front of a moving train car. And to make matters worse, this doofus, rather than take two steps literally in either direction, this dude started backpedaling and tried to outrun it, which didn't work at all. All he has to do is just go left or right. And instead he's on the tracks. And he's backpedaling. So, like, he deserves whatever happens to him at this point. A few moments later, Duncan had been dragged 75 feet beneath the heavy wheels of this train car. His entire lower half had been nearly severed from the rest of his body and was lying in a tangled heap inside the wheels. After quickly assessing how much pain he was in, which was a lot, he then thought to grab his cell phone from his pocket and call for help. So, hey, at least he does make some good decisions, right? He calls paramedics, and while he's waiting for them to come out, he thought about his wife and kids, which was apparently enough to take to like shake off the sleepy feeling that must come when you're about to die. The paramedics eventually arrived on the scene and used airbags to gently lift the train car. And after sitting beneath the train for an hour, Duncan was actually still alive and was airlifted back to Fort Worth, despite losing over half of the blood in his body. After 4 months and 23 surgeries, Duncan's left leg was amputated at the hip while the right leg was amputated above the knee. He also lost most of his pelvis and a kidney in this accident. Other than that, though, he made a full recovery and was actually even awarded an office job back at the rail yard. All right, part three of Amazing Tales of Survival in the books. If you want to check out the first two parts, go back and listen to episodes 124 and 125. But let's recap today and see what we learned.
What did we learn?
Number one, Charles Lightoller. Survived a ton of issues before he got on the Titanic, and then was also on the Titanic and was kind of in charge of the people who were supposed to prevent the Titanic from sinking. And then he was the last survivor, actually rescued from that. Ultimately, then got back into war and more ships and stuff, and still had ships sink, survived all of it, lived a full life, and just a crazy life in general. Number two, Channing Moss somehow got shot with an entire rocket, like just a big old sourdough loaf. Now, sourdough's not that big. Italian. I'm still going Italian or French bread. Just a big old rocket, you know. Probably like 2 or 3 feet long. I don't know why I couldn't just say that to begin with. Instead, I had to use a food comparison. Like a 2 to 3 foot big rocket inside of his body. And they extracted it. And he lived, which is wild. And then number three, listen, if you ever find yourself falling on railroad tracks, even if a train is coming at you, just, you know, don't keep running on the tracks. Just kind of take one or two steps to the side and get off them. Next week on Our Weird World, we are revisiting another topic we have covered previously. Back on episode 55, it is part two of Demented Doctors. Three stories next week of just doctors who are not good. Like, they were probably good at being medical experts, but they did a lot of bad things with that knowledge, is the point that I am trying to articulate here. Three stories next week of Donald Harvey, Charles Cullen, and John Bodkin Adams to make you feel all nervous and weird next time you go get your checkup. So that's it. Thanks for listening. Keep telling all your friends and keep it weird.